Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 2 for November 11th, 2006, The Blogger in Question.
Hello and welcome to Episode 2 of This Week in Law. This is Denise Howell, I'm your host here on the TWiT.tv network, and I'm really excited today. We've got a great panel for you. On the line with me right now are Ernie Svensson of the Ernie the Attorney blog. Welcome, Ernie, to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Kathy Kirkman of Wilson Sonsini and the Silicon Valley Media Law blog. Kathy, great to have you.
Hi there.
And by way of introduction of our special guest today, I'm going to go ahead and play a clip from episode 71 of TWiT, This Week in Tech, with my esteemed colleagues talking about the Google and YouTube merger that recently happened when it was still in the rumor phase.
Now, this is a bogus story from the get-go.
Journal is fooled. Film at 11.
By a blogger. By gosh.
That's the funniest thing, that they're quoting a blogger.
So, our special guest this week is Mike Arrington, the infamous blogger in question. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. And you know, what's funny is I actually know Leo pretty well. I'm surprised he didn't, maybe because he was slamming me, he didn't want to name me directly.
I don't know if he meant to be slamming you necessarily. I think he was just struck by the collision of the esteemed Wall Street Journal and the blogosphere on this story. And before we jump into that, I'll just mention that John Palfrey, who is our other semi-irregular panelist of Harvard's Berkman Center, is planning on joining us. I did get an email from him before the show that he's sitting in an airport lounge and is going to try and Skype in as soon as he can, so we'll add him to the show as soon as he is able. But let's start off by talking about this Google-YouTube merger and acquisition, I should say, and Michael's role in breaking that story. Michael, as I understand it, you got an email that tipped you that this was happening. Is that right?
Yeah. So I tend to work pretty late at night, and in fact, I tend to work till 6 or 7 in the morning usually, and so the time of this call, it's 10 in the morning right now, is a little bit rough for me. But the best stuff comes in overnight, and I got an email at, I don't know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning with the tip, and I followed up on it. I called a venture capitalist friend of mine who I know tends to work late as well, and he confirmed with me that he had heard the rumor. In fact, he said he was going to call me the next day with it, and I decided to go with it. I mean, that's pretty weak, just having sort of an email tip and then confirming that there's a rumor actually circulating isn't much of a confirmation, but you know, I thought it was enough to at least go with what I wrote.
Now, was this an anonymous tip?
No, it was I just didn't disclose who it was, but it was somebody who has never been wrong before in giving me tips, and I decided that they were a credible source.
That's great. So you had it up on TechCrunch with all kinds of disclaimers that this was absolutely, positively rumor material.
Yeah, the problem is that sometimes these rumors may be true in the sense of their discussions have taken place, maybe even an offer has been put on the table, but it hasn't been accepted, or they're still working through, you know, the contract, which could take a week or 6 months, and so it's hard to. I didn't realize it was as imminent as it was. You know, the journal recently talked about Yahoo buying Facebook for $1 billion, and that hasn't happened yet. And their source was probably just as good on that story as my source was for this story, if not better. But you know, clearly something happened to those discussions, and it didn't happen. So you know, I don't want to embarrass myself by saying something was definitely going to happen, and you know, and then it doesn't.
Now, I don't subscribe to the print version of the Wall Street Journal, so can't get to it online and couldn't go read the story they actually printed. But I take it they sourced you in their story. Is that right?
They said they had their own source. And then they also mentioned that I had also published the rumor. And then the New York Times did the same thing later that day. So it wasn't 100% clear if they had their own source or not. But I would have to imagine they didn't even call me. I'd have to imagine that they did. And in fact, my understanding is that they have somebody inside at Google that, you know, feeds them information. I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't Google's PR group. So
what do you think of the deal itself?
You know, there's a couple ways to look at it. I mean, I'd love to talk about, I'm sure we will talk about the copyright issues today. You know, there's people on the phone. I think every single person on the phone is more qualified to talk about this than me, and I'm looking forward to hearing your comments on that. But I think that there is some copyright risk there, and I think in particular the studios and the TV networks could still get together and do something here to try to stop YouTube from owning this space. From a pure ROI or return on investment strategy by Google, the deal doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. If you look at 100 million videos being shown daily, even adding advertising to those videos on any kind of reasonable CPM or RPM basis, just the numbers don't even come close to adding up. So Google clearly, paid a premium to get into, the number one spot on video. And that, I don't know how they value that internally, but at least $1.65 billion, I guess.
Yeah, the copyright ramifications of it are pretty fascinating. The best take on it, or the one that rang truest to me, was Fred Von Lohman's from his interview with John Battelle on SearchBlog, where he likened this to the early days of the internet, and when the big ISPs would make sure that they controlled the playing field on how the law was going to develop, and that there could be some aspect of that in the Google deal, wanting to be, a party to these suits rather than letting them unfold in a way that would affect them down the road without their being to participate in any way other than as an amicus in somebody else's lawsuit. And that rang particularly true to me, given sort of my high opinion of Google's legal staff and what their track record is and what they've been able to accomplish.
Well, I was wondering how the deal that YouTube entered into before announcing the deal with Google, with Sony and Universal, whether that was that part of a strategy that Google participated in? I mean, that's buying, it seems to be buying off part of the problem, not the whole problem, or at least getting buy-in so that those people are not going to threaten to sue. Universal having threatened to sue before, forget the fellow's name, but
the guy
is that
who said
possible?
They owe us tens. Huh? The guy who said they owe us tens of millions of dollars.
I mean, is it possible that Google participated in that? I mean, how did that? I'm not familiar with these deals, so I don't know how they go down. And I guess Mike, you would know, and so would you, Catherine. But would that be something that Google would?
Didn't Google announce the same deals with the same companies on the same day on Monday morning? Weren't they roughly the same companies?
Yes.
That they announced 6 hours. So clearly there was, some kind of discussion going on.
Because that strikes me as very smart. They're getting in, if they're buying off part of the problem, or they're making part of the problem go away, and then if Fred Lohman is right, Von Lohman is right, that they have looked at this as a way of controlling that issue, and I applaud Google if they would take on such a difficult legal question as part of this deal, but I guess I just don't really understand it. You're 100 million videos a day. How do they make money? They're doing it purely altruistically so that they can control the space and define how those legal challenges are shaped. I just don't get it.
Could I frame a question as well to add to what Ernie just said?
Sure thing.
And I think, Catherine is probably, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, but Wilson Sonsini, where you work, represents both Google and YouTube in copyright infringement, if I'm correct. And I don't know to what extent that's going to limit what you can say.
Well, that's why, yeah, that's why I haven't spoken up. I, you know, would obviously really love to address a lot of this, but I'm not in a position to do so for exactly those reasons. I guess what I'm interested in, and then I'll let you frame your question. This is sort of an aside, Mike, but it drives me crazy when I look at the New York Times article and they link to various websites, and then they say the TechCrunch blog and they don't link out to you. That drives me crazy. That's a total aside, but I just don't get that at all.
I'll tell you that, and Denise, feel free to edit this out if you'd like before you go live with this. But so I published the rumor on Thursday. The deal was announced on Monday. Over the weekend, I was in Washington for an ONA, Online News Association conference, where they brought me in ostensibly to be sort of the interesting speaker to talk about, you know, what's going on in blogging and how they can do more to be successful like bloggers. And it was clear that I was brought in to be the sacrificial lamb of the conference. And I sort of got into my issues with the New York Times and how they don't link out. And I was surprised they even mentioned TechCrunch in the article, to be honest. And the Wall Street Journal is pretty good about that. The New York Times isn't. And I was absolutely crucified at that conference, both at the conference and then in blog posts afterwards. And my biggest concern was, or my biggest issue was, the big newspapers, even in their online properties, still don't want to facilitate a conversation where everybody is talking about an issue with credibility, can link to each other. They just don't do it. And it's this old school mentality of, we're the New York Times, no other news source really exists, and we're certainly not going to send any traffic that way. Yeah, it bugs me too, but it certainly is hurting them as well. If they were linking to bloggers, bloggers would link to them much more often.
No way I'm editing that out. I read your saga on Crunch Notes and felt for you intensely about that whole experience and the timing of it, not to mention just the logistics of going back there just in time to be there and participate and you know, what ensued after that. So I congratulate you on your willingness to participate in that and to forge ahead.
I thought it was going to be a big, you know, group hug, and I didn't realize, you know, how much old media, and I even, you know, I get in trouble because I count companies like CNET and as old media, and they don't like being called old media. But I, you know, how much old media tends to resent, you know, what's going on today, and also how much they resent outsiders, you know, like non-journalists coming in and doing things that, you know, sort of tread on their territory. And, you know, all of us on the call are in the category of outsiders as far as they're concerned, and the last thing they want is us, you know, coming in and being journalists. So,
yeah,
Catherine, could I frame a question then, sort of with the caveat that you're going to have to be very careful in how you answer the questions?
Well, I mean, you can frame it, but I'm really not going to address questions about YouTube or Google, because that's, you know, something I'm not in a position to talk about, although I'd love to, but...
Well, could I ask a question about copyright infringement in general?
Sure.
And the DMCA? It's actually an area that I don't understand. You know, I'm sort of vaguely familiar with the DMCA and the safe harbor provision for, you know, putting up, you know, allowing users to put up content and then taking it down when you get a takedown notice. My question is, can you or Denise or somebody just explain to me, you know, how the safe harbor tends to go away if you're making, you know, what exactly are the limits to what you can do with that content? Can you make revenue from that content? And if you do generate revenue, does that remove the safe harbor or not?
Well, there have been cases with Amazon and eBay where they've been held to be within the safe harbor, notwithstanding that they're a platform for, you know, for transactions and they derive revenue. But essentially the safe harbor, you know, if it's sort of the requirements are laid out in the statute, and there's, you know, technical requirements in terms of the whole notice and takedown regime that you're probably familiar with.
Sure.
And then there's some, you know, other requirements that are, you know, interpreted by the case law about knowledge, actual apparent knowledge, financial benefit, right? And in the case where you have right and ability to control. And so that's where, you know, the case law is probably the best guidance.
It's the knowledge part of it that has always intrigued me, particularly in the context a video sharing type site, because all of them are scrambling to be able to control and monitor and watermark and basically examine the things that people are posting. And there are a lot of folks out there who practice law in this area that will tell you that if you're monitoring, your DMCA safe harbor goes away, that you basically have to be turning a blind eye to the activity. So I think that could be a real interesting collision of policy and practice in this area.
Yeah, and I think there's case law that has said that, you know, that that, you know, does not impact your safe harbor, and actually the opposite, like with the Amster case of turning a blind eye is something that the courts don't, you know, look favorably on.
What about just putting advertising up around the content in an automated way? Does that have a, have, is there a problem there with the, with losing your safe harbor provision?
Well, like Kathy said, there is a provision in the statute that deals with how you are monetizing or creating revenue around what you're doing. And I'm not aware of any cases that have specifically dealt with that issue. So I think it's an open question. When this comes up, it's certainly going to be examined in court.
One thing that intrigues me about all this discussion and this issue of the DMCA, YouTube, dovetails with RSS feeds and the whole discussion, notably between Robert Scoble and others, about whether if you put it out there and syndicate it, that it can just be used in whatever manner somebody else wants to use it without regard to your rights. And that's, this is sort of a boiling point. These two things are coming together. All these things are coming together. And it seems to me that there's a fundamental thing that we're jumping over as lawyers, not us on this conference call, but just lawyers in general and the legal system in general, and that is that these copyright laws were in place to do certain things, to incentivize creativity and to incentivize people to release this information and to make it available. And we're now obsessed with controlling those things, which is great. I mean, that's fine. You have a legal right to do it and so forth. But I think what we're seeing is that that model that you needed to incentivize it really isn't necessarily true, or at least it's not true in the same way that it was back when the copyright laws were created. And I don't know if I'm making sense when I say that, but it just seems to me that's sort of the point where all of this tension gets created, because we know the reality is people are freely producing and launching things and putting it out there, and they're not really too worried about their copyright, their copyrights. And yet at the same time, having put it out there, if somebody tells them, well, you can protect this, well, you know, some of them are interested in it, some of them are not. That's what I find fascinating.
Well, Ernie, I think that was really well put. And actually, I think I've never heard the EFF say what you just said, but it sounds like the kind of thing that the EFF would want to be, you know, be saying. Just in that, you know, the world has changed dramatically since, you know, in the last 10 years. And Do the old copyright laws even apply? Should they even apply to the world we live in today? And I have a couple of comments on that. One is, I think it's fascinating to watch, you know, forgetting the legal part, the legal issues around YouTube, I think it's fascinating to see how YouTube has decided they're going to have a different faith than Napster. With Napster, they were just litigated to death. With YouTube, before that really happened, before those issues came up, they managed to pull off deals with a lot of content providers. And I think it wasn't so much that they were aggressive in attempting to get deals done, because Napster was trying to do the same. It seems to me that they got so successful so fast, and the consumer demand for the YouTube product was so clear, that the content providers realized that exactly what you said, Ernie, that the world has changed, and simply litigating against these guys may not be the best idea. And in fact, some of the litigation that did happen may have only been a preamble to, you know, getting a deal done and to try to get a little bit more leverage. And so YouTube may be pulling something off by completely doing an end around, the copyright laws.
Well, to Ernie's point about the copyright law, I mean, Larry Lessig, Professor Lessig, you know, his book Free Culture and a lot of his work, I think has really stated it well in terms of you know, calling it a perfect storm in terms of there's a longer copyright term, there's not the formalities associated with copyright registration and notices that used to exist to have a copyright, and then everything digital, of course, touches copyright, rights under copyright. So it is a very interesting, sort of theme of the times, and Creative Commons and the like. A lot of people are exploring interesting ways to create new paths in that environment.
The other thing that I think is really interesting as the perfect storm sort of comes together is the way that the people who are the defendants in one case might be the plaintiffs in the next. You know, I mean, they all have interests that are at cross purposes with each other as they scramble to try and get into and take advantage of this arena. And the thing I'm thinking of specifically are these lawsuits that were filed by Universal Music against Grouper, which was acquired by Sony, which, you know, this makes no sense to me, and Bolt, which I know less about. But, you know, getting back to Michael's question about the DMCA, you know, I think with these two suits pending against these video sharing sites, that may be the first place where we get some answers to these DMCA safe harbor questions.
One question, Mike, I wanted to ask you is, in terms of, you see a huge sort of, you know, flood of new businesses wanting to, you know, get visibility on TechCrunch. To what extent, you know, how would you characterize what you are seeing in terms of businesses around rights and rights being cleared and rights being, you know, as Ernie alluded to in the RSS feed area, you know, not as clear in terms of the rights place. What are you seeing?
Ask that question differently. Are you asking about, am I seeing startups that are trying to deal with this problem, like by helping others, you know, handle rights clearances? Or are you asking, are there startups that are either ignoring or trying not to ignore copyright laws in general?
Well, I wouldn't say ignoring. I'm just saying, are you seeing, so it's not startups to service rights clearance agencies, but are you seeing a lot of, you know, the new startups that you're seeing, you know, looking to find new ways of dealing with copyrighted materials, such as, you know, aggregating feeds, et cetera, and, you know, doing new things in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at, if I were to sort of poll the entrepreneurs that I talk to, I think that more and more they think of text. They don't link text to copyright in their mind. And you know, RSS is this crazy thing that you know, has done nothing to strip copyright, you know, rights away from the author, but has made it incredibly easy for people to steal or borrow content and republish it and mash it up and do things like that. And to a large extent, authors have turned a blind eye. I mean, every day, things that I've written, my copyright is violated, and I just kind of go with it because there's absolutely nothing I can do with it. And in fact, it's good for my business. But when it comes to, you know, sound or sort of rich media, I think entrepreneurs do take a different view of that, and they try to at least work within the DMCA to avoid or minimize or mitigate any liability issues that they might have. But it's not out of a respect for the copyright. It's out of a hope to get funded and realization that they may not if they don't do that.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. You know, as you're sitting here trying to think about what are the biggest legal issues confronting the online world at the moment, I think this is one of them, given the way that RSS facilitates the way that things move around the network, and given the way that it's being used in applications that you just would never have thought of before. I saw a ClickZ article by Rebecca Lieb. People are distributing coupons via RSS and press releases, and there are deal and product feeds, and even Burpees has a seed feed of all things. You know, I mean, if you think about any kind of content, you could pretty much get it out there by RSS, and there's probably every reason to do so. And the more that happens, I think the more we're going to see confusion and collision of law and the freedom to reuse this stuff. There's a plugin now for WordPress that was created by a guy named, I assume it's a guy, Angusman Chakraborty, if I'm pronouncing that right, that basically facilitates your adding a copyright notice to your feed. And I thought the text of his notice was pretty telling. It tells people reading the material from the feed, if you are not reading this in your news aggregator, the site you are looking at is guilty of copyright infringement, and please contact us so we can do something about that. So, you know, I think there's a whole slew of attempts to deal with this in various ways. There's the Creative Commons module for RSS 2.0 that also embeds some information in a feed. But, you know, as a practical matter, what do you guys think about the effectiveness of giving that kind of information in a way that may never be viewed by the end user or reader? You know, how many people look at their feeds?
Well, I think that, you know, in terms of whether it's looked at or not, I mean, if you're putting out what the licensing terms are around your content, then, you know, that, you know, you've stated what the terms are, as opposed to there's this, you know, of course, this whole question about scope of implied licenses and all that. So to me, it reminds me of, especially with these aggregation plays, you know, was it 10 years ago and the whole, you know, Total News and the whole framing of news content and how that will play out in terms of, you know, the people who don't mind having their feeds used and or reused because they see a value in that, and, you know, maybe bigger media who has terms or licenses that, you know, they would decide that they wouldn't want to permit that usage.
Yeah, the thing that causes me some concern is the potential and likelihood for confusion if people are trying to put as much copyright information out there as they can, you know, on the site where the material is available and in the feed itself and possibly in the thing being distributed via the feed, whether it's text or audio or video. And it just strikes me that with so many people who aren't represented by lawyers hand-rolling this stuff themselves, they're going to say one thing in one place and another thing in another place, and all of their efforts will go to naught because it will just revert. It'll either be some sort of implied license that they never actually expressly agreed to, or it will revert to the blanket copyright protection.
Well, I keep going back to what Ernie said, which is that the world has changed and copyright law has not kept up. And I am literally of two minds on this. On the one hand, the EFF, and I might be the only person in the world that might say this other than, you know, people that generally try to enforce copyright laws, but the EFF annoys the hell out of me. You know, it seems to me, I was reading the John Battelle interview with, who was it from the EFF that he spoke to?
Fred Von Lohman,
who, in general, I respect his opinions, but if he was talking about YouTube and saying that, you know, they're generally on pretty firm legal ground, I think was, I don't want to misquote, but I think that's what he said. And that may or may not be the case, although I think definitely there's something, you know, there is an issue that needs to be discussed around YouTube putting advertising around copyrighted content, and is that okay? Whether or not it's legal, is it okay for somebody to do that? I wonder, you know, if the EFF, if I were to take, you know, first-run movies that I record at the theater with my DVD player, I'm sorry, with my high-def camera, burn DVDs and start selling them on a website, you know, if the EFF would have a problem with that, or if there's at any point where they draw the line and say, you know, okay, maybe that's something you shouldn't do with regard to copyright infringement. And, you know, I'm sure I'll get an email from those guys. I'm also a donor to them, so, you know, I feel somewhat comfortable attacking them. But I wonder, like, you know, if they've gone off the deep end when it comes to, you know, to clearly not respecting copyright at all. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, I don't think copyright even really exists anymore. When I write something, I don't look to copyright to, or even when I, you know, do a podcast or something like that, I don't look to copyright to protect me. You know, I look to the fact that I got it out first, and I have a few minutes at least of head start before people start copying the content and putting it up on spam blogs. And, you know, in general, I can build a business around that, and that's okay. I'm not sure if the law can ever really protect what I'm doing without, you know, without destroying what the internet is and what makes it wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, you've really hit on the second prong of the problem that Ernie flagged. Not only has copyright not kept up, but our dispute resolution system is so abysmally bad, you know, that enforcing your copyrights just isn't even really a practical option. Unless all you
especially
want to do with
for
your
somebody
time.
Without a lawyer. There's no way to do it.
Well, even as a lawyer, I mean, look at how many lawyers attempt to protect the stuff on their blog. I mean, Denise, you and I put out our full feeds, and I've thought about it, and I know Marty Schwimmer occasionally gets irked with sites that take his content and then repurpose it. I don't worry about it, largely for the reasons that Michael just suggested. I don't really have time to worry about that. I know how to litigate. I do it for a living, but I'm not going to get involved in that. That would take up all my time. So I'd rather just look at it and focus on the benefits, which there are benefits. And I think this highlights what Mike said earlier, which is I'm of two minds, too. I may be of three minds. I don't know how many minds I am, but I also feel that copyright law is sort of irrelevant to a lot of what goes on. And I know that sounds strange for a lawyer to say that, but since you went ahead and said it first, Mike, I'll echo that. I think it is irrelevant. And I think the reason it becomes irrelevant in a lot of areas is because it doesn't fulfill the need. And there's the greater need that's being fulfilled is people want information. They want to share videos. Yes, on YouTube, there's a lot of stuff that's copyright protected and shouldn't be up there. But there's also a lot of stuff up there that's useful. And this is where I would distinguish YouTube from Napster. When I saw Napster the first time, I thought, oh, this is great. I can download albums for free. That's, of course, the side of me that's not the lawyer thinking. But it was wonderful, and I used it to find music that I wanted to hear, a song that somebody mentioned, and I didn't want to have to go buy it. I just wanted to hear it. So but the only way to use Napster was pretty much copyright infringement, or at least that's the way it was used. YouTube, on the other hand, I see it used in a lot of beneficial ways that have nothing to do with copyright infringement. My friend had a wedding the other day. I took a wedding video with my little pocket camera. It turned out to be really great. He said, would you please upload it so everybody could see it? And I said, gee, YouTube is the perfect place for that. So I did. A lot of people have viewed it. It's a useful tool. And, you know, it fulfills a purpose. The copyright law that would get in the way of that being allowed if YouTube were shut down doesn't really fulfill that larger purpose of those people who are trying to use it for legitimate means.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I'm looking forward. It doesn't look like John's probably going to be able to join us today. I haven't seen him try and jump on the call here. But I'm looking forward to a future show when we can talk with him about that. He had a really interesting post about taking a marketplace approach to copyright law and copyright enforcement and the nuances of brokering deals between people without a whole lot of legal intervention. So I'm interested to pick his brain on that further, because I think Creative Commons provides, you know, an interesting first start, but not a whole lot of real practical commercial solutions. And I think that's, you know, as people continue to try and look to the web as their business platform, I think that's going to become more and more important.
One thing I would like to say in response to your comments, Mike, which I think are pretty provocative, is that, and this is speaking from my own view and not of any client, is that, you know, if your primary business isn't being a copyright holder, that doesn't mean that you don't respect copyrights and respect the intellectual property rights of others and work within, you know, the law and the legal system. And, you know, the copyright law is written such that a copyright holder does have substantial legal remedies in connection with infringement. They can pursue statutory damages, which in a willful situation can be up to $150,000 per copyright violation. So, you know, the Copyright Act is alive and well, and, you know, and the copyright term was extended. So it seems that there's, you know, strong protection for copyright owners, and there are, at the same time, bounds to the scope of what the copyright law, covers, which I kind of goes, I think, back to Ernie's point.
So, Mike, I'm looking at the clock. I know you were going to have to jump off and go do your duties at the Gilmore Gang. And if you need to leave us now, that's perfectly fine.
We recorded the Gilmore Gang yesterday for some reason, and this like 2 hour. It'll be a 6-part marathon, and so I'm actually free for a little bit longer.
Oh, that's great! Wonderful, wonderful to keep you with us then.
I will say this is a much more polite crowd than the Gilmore Gang. You know, the way Catherine just respectfully disagreed with part of my point was, I mean, if that was Steve Gilmore, he would have used some expletives, a number of them, and then he would have hung up on me. So it's almost like I've been hanging out with the tough kids around, you know, and I'm used to getting in a lot of street fights, and I don't really know how to deal with, you know, an intelligent, well reasoned, dispassionate argument by Catherine. I'm speechless.
Well, we can, you know, we can start calling names. You know, Denise, where do we want to go with this, you know?
So, you know, it's a podcast or a netcast, so there's no FCC regs that I'm aware of that would come into play.
All right, well, let me throw out another controversial statement, which isn't fair because Catherine just isn't going to be able to address this. But, let's just get to the nuts and bolts of YouTube. Ernie talks about wedding videos, and that's great. And I agree, it's very valuable. But while probably the majority of videos uploaded to YouTube have little or no copyright infringements, and I say little because if a couple of kids are lip-syncing a song, whether or not that's against the law or against it violates copyright, I couldn't care less. I think that is nothing but free promotion for the studios, for the labels in that case. But in the case of, you know, a full Saturday Night Live skit being put up on the site, or a full segment from The Daily Show being put up on the site, whether or not it's good for The Daily Show or for Saturday Night Live, I think it is very good for the promotion, free promotion for them. I have to say that having that up on the site with and YouTube has full knowledge it's up there. I bet the YouTube employees are watching it themselves, along with an advertisement, just strikes me as really pushing things, and I know I would be upset if somebody took my podcast, generate the kind of massive traffic, but if somebody took a funny part of one of my podcasts and put it up on their site and then put an ad around it, I'd be a little pissed off about that. And again, that happens with the text that I write every single day. And for some reason, I'm not concerned with that because I'm not. But something about the rich media just gets me. It makes me a little bit more careful before I say that isn't a big deal.
Yeah, what I would say is, you know, unfortunately, I'm not in a position to address this, although I would love to. And YouTube's folks have, you know, addressed all this publicly. And it, I guess next time we should get someone from YouTube so we can have the YouTube hour, but so I'll let, you know, Ernie or Denise take it, but I do.
So you're folding, in effect. You've agreed that the weight of my arguments is too much for you to even respond.
No, not at all.
She's not agreeing to that.
You know, I mean, Denise knows the ground rules, you know. I would, of course, love to talk about all kinds of things, but, you know, I'm a lawyer, I'm a professional representative, and I'm not in the position to do so. So,
and we're thrilled, you know, that you're here talking, even though, you know, you do have some ethical constraints on you. Much, much better to have you be partially participating in the conversation than not at all.
Yeah, I agree.
But back.
And I was obviously kidding.
But back to the question. I mean, you know, the one thing the DMCA does that is going to have its grand test in this context is it puts the onus on the copyright holder rather than on the online service provider. In this case, the video sharing site. Now we get into a couple of issues there. You know, nobody has ever concluded in a court of law, as far as I know, that a video sharing site qualifies as somebody who is entitled to the protections of the DMCA safe harbor. So that's a question on the front end that needs to be answered. But, you know, assuming you can clear that hurdle and assuming that simply hosting 100 million downloads worth a day of videos puts you in the realm of someone like an email host or a conventional ISP, then I think, you know, that there's actually some merit to having the DMCA work the way it is designed. I mean, obviously, there's a difference between the kids' dance video and the Saturday Night Live skit. But when you're dealing with third-party users who are posting content up and there's no screening process that, you know, goes into play before they can actually post, and when you've got that kind of volume, you know, I don't know how somebody in a video sharing site's position can do anything other than point to the copyright holders and say, look, you guys have to help us police. I don't know how.
Yeah, how could they screen that? I mean, screening would be tedious, difficult, cumbersome, and completely unworkable. I mean, even banks don't verify every signature on every check. They couldn't.
Right. So, I mean, that's the thing that is going to get, I think, a lot of heated debate in courts, because, you know, of course, there's also the Grokster decision coming into play, and the fact that if you're building a business around encouraging infringement, you're going to be in trouble. And, you know, the more that it's easy and, in fact, part of the expected process that people put up copyrighted unlicensed material on sharing sites, then the more you're going to hear big media companies scream about it.
You know what really bothers me about the prospect of courts deciding these things, and this is said as somebody who clerked for a judge who pays a lot of attention to how judges think, because it matters in litigating cases. But what I find really disconcerting about the prospect of these things being litigated is that these are really cutting-edge legal issues, and they're cutting-edge social issues, and they're going to be decided in a lot of cases by judges who mean very well and who want to apply the law and reach a sensible result. But, you know, you can't just apply precedent and analogize from pre-existing law and situations, because a lot of this stuff is completely novel, or it's occurring in a novel way, or it has novel benefits. It's not the same situation that existed 10 or 20 years ago, and yet you're going to have judges who are completely unfamiliar with the use of this technology. And, you know, it's not a question of just saying, well, what was the Grokster decision, and like a robot applying it. You have to take, I mean, I would hope that the judge would have some global sense or some larger sense of how these decisions are going to play out. And yet, every time I look at a decision being rendered by a court, in most cases, I find that the courts are really struggling, the judges are really struggling to understand this technology. They really just, you know, most judges are not immersed in the world of technology in the way that the litigants are. And it's you know, I know that judges don't always have to understand the world that they're dealing with, but they usually understand it a lot better, even if they're somewhat unfamiliar with the area of law that they're the area of society or whatever that they're dealing with. They're usually more familiar with it than they are in the case of technology. I mean, there's a huge disparity between the knowledge of the area that they're dealing with on the part of these judges. That's what I find really disconcerting, which is why it's impossible to predict how these things are going to play out. I mean, you could sit here and speculate for a long time as to how the YouTube problem will be litigated, but in the end, the only thing I think you can predict for sure is that if it's litigated soon, it's going to be litigated, and the judge who gets the case is highly likely to not understand the technology involved.
Right.
And I know that's...
And to have a whole lot of conflicting precedent and no clear bright line guidance on the point you raised earlier about the role of non-infringing uses versus infringing ones, and the percentage that needs to be shown, and how you do that math in the case of something that really does have a whole lot of social value, as you also pointed out, in addition to its undeniable copyright infringement function. That was a tough issue that came up in the Napster case that just never quite... you're right, this is a different situation, and And, you know, going back to the Betamax decision, I think that's one. And you look at the conflicting and sort of dueling dissents from the Grokster decision on that very point, and you kind of got to throw up your hands and go, you know what, this is all just fair game, and somebody's going to have to do what feels right to them, and hopefully they can do so with the best advocacy that is possible and make the soundest decisions. But, you know, as we know, that doesn't always happen. So there's something I wanted to get into before we wrap up the call today, because it's been much in the news in the legal blogosphere, and we are all lawyers with blogs. And I think that it's something that is pertinent, because I think it's important that you have professionals. You know, as I was saying to Kathy a little while ago, I think it's very important that even people who have constraints on the way they can participate, work within those constraints and participate nonetheless, you know, as much as possible for the health of our growing society. And one of the things that is being looked at hard by a lot of states is whether lawyer blogs, and I assume by extension lawyer podcasts or lawyer videocasts, any sort of putting yourself out there, should be regulated as advertising. And the thing about lawyer advertising, you know, going back to the days when lawyers were not permitted to advertise on at all, let alone on something like a television, the rules on lawyer advertising are very onerous, and there's a lot of record keeping involved. And the upshot of it is that, you know, if lawyer blogs and these other things are regulated like advertising, people just aren't going to be able to participate because the requirements on them are going to be too stiff. Have you guys paid attention to this, and are you frightened?
I paid attention to it because you directed my attention to it earlier this week, and I think it's a bunch of nonsense, personally. Mm-hmm. Hopefully this wouldn't apply to me, and I'm still a member of the bar. Would this apply to me as a member of the bar on any blog that I write?
I don't think so. I mean, I think I looked at the New York
because I'd have to laugh at it pretty hard if they tried to make that apply to me.
Yeah, I looked at the New York regulations, and I think, first of all, this has to be put in context. And I think that what the bar associations are trying to do is not focus really on blogs. In fact, the New York regulations never mention weblogs. They're more about advertising in general. That they don't define how a blog could become an advertisement, and I think, and my own view would be that Michael's blog, which is not about the law, or, you know, and I didn't even know he was a lawyer until I started looking at your bio. So I mean, that's not a lawyer blog, first of all, and you're not writing about the law. If you're marketing yourself as a lawyer and you're doing it in a very directed, pointed way, and most of your posts are about things marketing yourself, then maybe you are a website that could be regulated as advertising. Between those two areas, there's a huge gulf, and it's a gray area, and I don't know what the New York Bar Association or other bar associations intend to do, but I think if they do intend to regulate casual blog posts of the sort that I put out or the sort that Denise puts out or the sort that even Catherine puts out on her blog, I think that would be elitist and reductive, as Julie Hilden says. And I also think that if they're trying to protect something, either the profession's image as a whole, which I think that's very difficult to do in this way, or if it's to prevent people from being taken advantage of, I think in both cases they are they're focusing on the wrong thing. And I think there's a huge difference between television advertising, where you sit there and you're forced to see some guy using a trebuchet to hurl a car to promote his accident practice, and somebody who's surfing the internet, who's actively seeking out information, and if they find a weblog, it's because they wanted to. So I think there's a huge difference there, which is not recognized in those regulations, but I don't think that they're intended to apply to blogs, and I think if the bar associations are smart, they won't pick that fight.
Yeah, I sure hope not. There was an advisory opinion here in California a few years back when I first started blogging that caused me first to be concerned about these things because, you know, it was dealing with some medium other than blogging, obviously, but it was similar enough, and it found the communication to be advertising. I think it was an email communication. There was certainly no big stretch for the California bar to begin regulating blogs under its advertising rules, and I believe we have a proposed amendment pending here that would go down that route. So it's certainly something that I agree with Ernie that it would be completely counterproductive to what bars should be trying to encourage. You know, I mean, it kind of goes back to the percentage issue that we were talking about a moment ago with respect to copyright infringement and big clearinghouses of lots of content. You get a whole mixed bag of material when you unleash people writing weblogs or doing other live web activities on the world. And some of it, you know, I mean, we have, for example, Professor Patry, who is writing the most scholarly and insightful legal pontifications on very cutting edge and important issues. And, you know, this is important information for the world to have. And if he were to be somehow construed as doing that simply to promote himself as a practicing lawyer, I think it would be a tragedy and, you know, completely counterproductive to what we want to encourage professionals to do.
Yeah, I think that, you know, as lawyers, you know, our professional responsibilities are the most important thing, of course. Now, with blogs, I think it's something that, you know, perhaps people have to get their arms around, just the way that, you know, websites for law firms having websites 10 years ago, the bar just had to get its arms around what that meant, and now all the firms have websites. So, you know, if a blog could be said to be like a website or with a feed, et cetera, you know, so I think that, you know, these are things that need to be thought through because of the importance of our professional responsibilities. But at the same time, you know, I think, you know, there is context in terms of websites, newsletters, et cetera, that this could be viewed in.
And it's ironic to me because if you wanted to try to limit the output of blogs, and I don't think that that is what the bar associations are trying to do, but if that is the effect, I think that it's kind of ironic because the bar associations are always trying so hard to upgrade the image of our profession. And I realize that while there are some people who are going to use weblogs to do stupid things, some lawyers are going to do stupid things and have goofy ads or goofy videos or goofy sites, for the most part, that's not what's going on. And for the most part, what's been happening in the past 4 years, at least since I've been lawyer blogging along with Denise, is I have found a lot of lawyers who are able to talk about what they do in an everyday human way, and that people find that to be a good thing. They find that the law is demystified. They find that they look at lawyers in a different way, that lawyers are human beings, that lawyers have everyday concerns just like they do. And instead of seeing lawyers as obstructionist, as always standing in the way of things and saying no to new ideas, they see that lawyers are really trying to think through how to make things happen. You don't get that as easily from other media as you do. You certainly don't get it from law reviews or from other publications that lawyers put out. You get it from lawyer blogs. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, to think that there would be some impact to someone like Michael, who, you know, bit of a recovering lawyer, and even myself these days falling into that category more and more, simply because we're keeping up our bar licenses and, you know, accordingly complying in whatever context we have to with our professional responsibilities. It just seems like a ludicrous end result. You know, and I think there is something to be said for humanizing the law too. And you know, I know I enjoy getting to know the people in the legal blogosphere on a personal level, in addition to thoroughly enjoying the legal insights they're able to provide that I simply don't have. And
I agree with that, and it's a, you know, marketplace of ideas and people sharing, you know, views, and it also breaks down a lot of the hierarchy in the legal profession, which I think is wonderful in terms of communicating. You know, you could have young folks at a law school blogging and, you know, sharing their views. Joe Gratz, you know, it comes to mind. Dennis Crouch, you know, who's now a professor. And then you have people like, you know, like you said, like Bill Patrie, who are just so well esteemed in their field. So I've really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and you know, I haven't seen the movie yet that Robin Williams is starring in, but I take it the theme of it is sort of what would happen if we had a president who was actually a human being. And you know, I think that's an extraordinary thing to aspire to, and that the more people are able to express themselves in a professional and personal way and not be looked askance at for that, but recognizing that that's just, you know, part of the human condition, the better off we all are.
Yeah, we all have to learn it's okay to act like a human being, and lawyers, I think, need to learn that especially. And, you know, part of the reason, well, the reason I chose the name Ernie the Attorney for my weblog was that's what a magistrate in federal court used to call me when I worked there. And at first I was taken aback because she would say it in such a, you know, matter-of-fact way, like that was my name. And then I realized that her style was, she was very serious. You know, she had been a former U.S. attorney. She ran the courtroom like a tight ship, and everybody respected her. She commanded respect. Yet at the same time, she could turn to a juror after the juror said he wasn't married, say, "What, a good-looking man like you, not married?" And everybody would laugh, and it broke the ice, and it let everybody know that while we're here to do serious work, we don't need to take ourselves too seriously. And I think that's what happens in the legal profession, is that we do such serious work, and it's so important, we often forget how to take ourselves not so seriously.
Yes, well, that circles us right back to YouTube and the beneficial effects of lawyers being able to post the Crazy Frog Brothers video on their blogs and share that with the world. Have you guys seen this? It was something I caught last night on Robert Scoble's blog, and you got to go check it out. It's two kids lip-syncing. It's delightful.
I'm gonna check it out now.
it's one of these, you know, I think we're seeing it before it goes completely viral, but I think it will. So, you know, when people,
what is the video? Describe it to us.
Oh, it's two little boys. One of them is very tall and thin, and one of them is about half his height, and they are lip-syncing to a song that is a mashup of the theme music from Beverly Hills Cop.
I take it Ernie is now watching the video.
No, I'm my finger's hovering. I want to click on the link, but I won't do it because I know it'll make noise in the background.
The video itself has copyright ramifications on multi levels because you know, I don't know if the mashup itself was authorized, but it's that, you know, do 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 music from Beverly Hills Cop, and it's with some sort of very entertaining voice overlay talking about crazy frogs, and the shorter of the two little boys comes in and does the voice overlay throughout the video, and it's hard to describe. You've got to go watch it.
I love the it says the caption says, "Attention TV professionals, you are no longer needed. This is better than anything on ITV. Pack your bags. Goodbye."
And yeah, he's right. It's just, you know, I don't know that I could spend 100% of my video viewing time watching kids do lip sync videos, but I could spend a big part of it if they were all this funny.
You know what I'd love to see? I'm watching the video now. I'd love to see the same video, but with Dave Weiner and Robert Scoble doing it.
Now that I would pay for.
Good. Well, we'll make sure and email them a link to the show so that they can take the hint. Hey, folks, I'm really, really honored that you were able to join us here today, and thanks so much for doing so. Anything going on in the next week that you want to highlight for us before we sign off, Michael?
Well, I'll ask Catherine. Catherine, any big deals coming up that I should know about? just you and me talking here. No one else is listening. Is there anything just, you want to just give me a hint on to put me off the record?
Nose to the grindstone, as always. Working hard, serving clients.
Kathy, see, as a former Wilson lawyer, I know exactly like. I know, first of all, I know exactly how you're going to respond to almost everything I say, and it's just a lot of fun talking to you guys.
although Mike, I did say in a meeting yesterday to kind of illustrate a point, I said, you know, this is on your humanizing point, Denise. You know, money talks and bullshit walks, and the people were from Europe, and they're like, "What? Can I write that down? Is that American?" You know? So you know, sometimes we illustrate our well said points with, you know, catchy, you know, memorable phrases.
Yeah. Oh, hey, I agree 100%. Well, so if there is anything, though, if there is anything you want to let me know about, just send me an email and I'll make sure I it's completely off the record.
Yes, as we know, Mike protects his sources, so. Yeah.
Not going to happen, but hopefully, actually going to be in New York when your thing is, so maybe I'll touch base with you.
Are you going to come to my party?
Well, maybe, yeah. Maybe if you'll make an appearance at our Blog Law thing, if we can beg you, but we'd love to come to your party.
What's your Blog Law thing?
Well, there's this Blog Law conference that Denise was kind enough to do in the spring, but now it's in New York, so it's kind of East Coast people like Jeff Jarvis. And so just, you know, lawyers talking about Blog Law, and with Patrice there and Marty Schwimmer, some East Coast people.
I would love to attend. What's the date?
The 16th and the 17th. Maybe I'll shoot you.
Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. I just saw that you had your thing then, so maybe I'll shoot you an email, and we'd love to, if you could, make a cameo and wave to the crowd, and love to know about your event as well.
I will absolutely attend. If you send me an email, it's just editor@TechCrunch, and okay. But you have to go to my party that night in exchange.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, I wish I could go. I went to the first of these Blog Law seminars that Kathy's been spearheading, and they are phenomenal. At least the first one was absolutely terrific.
Well, everybody waited to the end because that's when the celebrities came on, and that was Denise's time to talk about life as a big-time blogger. So that's what made it.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, Denise, you're interesting. You firmly are in both worlds. You know, I definitely have no connections to the law blogs, you know, world, but you seem to be a celebrity in both.
Well, that's very kind and I think highly inaccurate, but I definitely...
I disagree, Denise.
Could I ever convince you, if I started like Law Crunch or something, could I ever convince you to drop everything you're doing and come work with me?
I don't think you could convince me to drop everything I'm doing, because I'm having way too much fun doing
it's
everything.
When you leave the law firm life, it's kind of it's like a huge weight is off your shoulder, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I left in the middle of the summer, and I had, you know, great languorous summer weeks with my son at the beach, and just, you know, the kind of time together that we really haven't had since I was out on maternity leave. And when I was out on maternity leave, he was too little to really enjoy it. So it's been, you know,
it's a lot different. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a great
time. Now you guys are bumming me out. Now I'm psyched. I'm here. It's Friday. I'm going to get to work after this.
That's right.
And then you're going to go. Are you going to be at work tomorrow too?
You know, I'll probably.
And then on Sunday.
I'll probably be at home. At
working.
Home.
Billing a few hours.
A few remote hours, going to my son's football game, you know, work-life balance and all that.
Do you bring a laptop to the football game?
No, don't do that. But I've got the BlackBerry, you know.
You actually seem to have some sort of sense of balance. The partners I worked with when I was at Wilson, you know, maybe things are, I don't know if they're different or not from when I was there in the late 90s, but it was insane then. And we all worked all the time, all the time.
I was there too.
Yeah, and I said
it was a busy time, but I've got two boys, so I have to keep it, you know, keep things balanced.
Kathy, which time was busier, now or then?
Wow, I guess, you know, it feels very. I mean, it was so busy then, and it's, you know, very busy now, so it's hard to tell.
Well, at least you got a little bit of a break in between while everybody held their breath and wondered if the web would survive.
There you go.
Fortunately, it has, and now it has things like MP3 audio going out via RSS feeds, and we appreciate the chance to jump onto everybody's iPods and computers and other media players in that fashion. And with that, folks, thanks again for joining us. It's been a really fun talk. And Michael, good luck with everything.
Thanks very much. Appreciate you having me on.
Sure. Take care, everyone.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Denise.